1620. Welcome to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. Hope you are having a great day today, whether you are listening live Saturday afternoon here on News Radio 92.3, or if you are listening to our podcast version of the show, which you can get wherever you get your podcasts, whenever you want to get it. You actually can listen to the show a little bit early, or you can listen to it at 4 o'clock on Saturday. I mean, I don't care. You listen to it at 2 in the morning on Wednesday if you want to. Just listen, for crying out loud. Anyway, we are going to hopefully, no matter what time and day you're listening to it, doesn't matter to me, but we're going to try to make your day just a little bit better by bringing you up to date with everything that's going on in entertainment and pop culture. Joining me to do so, as he does so very often on this show, please welcome Jeremy Branch.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure. Shout out to our friend Adam Wood, who came and checked out a movie with us last night. We'll be talking about a little bit later. We're kind of doing a catch-up show on some of the movies that are popping off in the movie theaters over the last couple of weeks that we hadn't had a chance to discuss on air, so I'm looking forward to that. But because this is a movie show and we talk about everything going on in the world of pop culture, I had to bring something up, Julio. I'm kind of curious about getting your take on some current news that's going on.
Okay.
So it was recently kind of announced, and I don't think in any official capacity, but our president, the 47th, Donald Trump, has a tendency to talk about a lot of things, and it's hard to kind of parse what is something that he actually has plans on addressing versus what are kind of just, you know, shooting from the hip things that he's saying right in the moment and it'll never come up again. But something that caught my ear and had me kind of pondering on it is the fact that he has floated the idea of not just tariffs, but 100% tariffs on films that are shot outside of the United States. And we're in a political climate where either you are on board with a politician and you endorse and co-sign everything they do, or you are not on the side of a politician, meaning that you are vehemently against any single thing that this politician proposes, says, or does. But the question I guess I have to you is, what do you think? Are there positives and minuses? Have you heard about this? What are your thoughts on 100% tariffs to Hollywood films shot outside the U.S.?
I think it is nice that we're trying to do something to address runaway production. I don't think that this is the solution. I think the solution is probably more incentive-based, which there was after that announcement. There was a more broad plan that included some of that kind of stuff, which I think is good. I think that the idea of tariffs on movies doesn't work the same as a tariff on a product. There's not a physical product to tax, and a tariff is a tax. Let's just be blunt about that. It also doesn't really address the way movies are made today, which kind of is a similar problem to addressing the way, you know, tariffs apply to cars, for example. You have, when you're making a car, some of the parts come from the United States and some of them come from other countries. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the vehicle crosses the border a few times before it's finished because different parts of it are done in different parts of the world. That's very much true of movies. You know, a lot of the effects houses, for example, are located overseas. You might have something that's shot in the U.S., but the special effects are added in New Zealand.
To something that you mentioned for the listeners, how do you define a runaway production?
I mean, the notion is that it's films made by American studios that are being produced elsewhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, case in point, this is the first one that happened to come up to my mind off the top of my head. They're currently shooting Supergirl, which is obviously a, you know, Warner Brothers film. Warner Brothers owns DC, owns all those characters. They're currently shooting that in London. So to some, that would be considered a runaway production because it's not being shot in general in the United States, and more specifically for those that are very heavily involved in this debate, it's not being shot in Southern California. Because
right.
That's where this really centers, because traditionally so much of the industry is based in Southern California. And I'm not unsympathetic with that. I've got a very good friend of mine who is a props mistress and involved in, creating and keeping track of the various, props and set dressing and things like that that are used in movies and television productions. And she's having trouble getting work right now because not enough's being produced in LA. She lives in LA. She moved to LA because that's where the work was.
Yes. And why is it that films shoot outside of the country?
Because it's cheaper.
Right.
For one reason or the other. Either it's cheaper because of incentives that are provided by that country's government. It's cheaper because labor is cheaper in general.
Mm-hmm.
And the big reason tends to be because the health costs are much, much, much less expensive in just about every other civilized nation in the world.
Yes.
Because most every civilized nation in the world has some sort of single-payer healthcare system or universal healthcare or, whatever you want to call it, to where the healthcare costs are taken care of by the government. So they're not having to pay mm-hmm. for somebody to have private insurance. They're not having to have, all kinds of additional policies over every worker on the set because that's already taken care of.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. We are definitely in a position where we're starting to see the way that capitalism kind of we're looking at Hollywood as a microcosm of something that is much bigger than that. I think it's interesting that Hollywood would, kind of be one that's so easily put on the chopping block. But as you mentioned, almost for everything from cell phones to cars, they might be manufactured in one place, but parts are coming from different places. There are lots of reasons why you would shoot outside of the U.S. that aren't related to budget. Like, for example, if you want to shoot at the Burj Khalifa or something, like, unless you're going to rebuild it, you want to be able to go to these real locations
sure.
and do, on location filming and stuff like that. But to your point, and the biggest reason why is they want to be able to produce things as cheap as possible and get the biggest returns off of them. So I do think that it is worth discussing how reforms can happen. And as you said, an incentive-based approach to it could actually be really beneficial for people that we know that are either A, working in the industry, or B, aspire to be. I mean, like when Georgia started getting all of these major productions, that was great for the local economy. There are people here that would love for studios to come and shoot in Pensacola, but until...
our state had an incentive program at one time. Our state had an incentive program at one time, and when it did, we had major production facilities mm-hmm. built in Orlando. Both Universal and Disney had, as part of the various parks that they have over there, had working movie studios on site.
Yep.
Those are closed now because we no longer have incentives in this state, and that you can see how little production is done here now. So, the incentives do work. I get that they cost money, but they also bring in money.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a catch-22. And, we're talking about, people in L.A. not being able to find work. Yes, those people can go other places and do go other places to work. My friend that I mentioned has definitely worked on stuff in Vancouver and, wherever a lot of stuff produces in Canada. They've also gone elsewhere in the States to work on productions. And, some of it is the nature of that business in that it is very much a freelance business.
Yes.
Overall, you're generally you're not under contract to a studio to be a grip on 20 movies in a year.
Right.
You get hired on a piecemeal basis. So, it also depends on, how able and willing you are to travel to do those things, because some people like to do things like have homes and families and pets. And, it's not necessarily easy to just drop everything and go to shoot in, Budapest for 6 months.
Yeah, it's like solutions are hard. The pointing out general issues is the easy part, and I think both of us can identify that, yes, there does need to be some serious reform, and we would love to see the industry in the U.S. thrive, but until there's a way to address the fact that unchecked capitalism always inevitably leads to this, it's going to be really difficult to see a clear way out of it. So I don't know. It is.
Yeah, we'll see what develops, but we've got to take a break. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.
something I've been wanting to tell you for a long time. It might hurt you, hope you don't lose your mind. Well, I was just a boy, about 8 years old. You threw me a Bible on that Mississippi road. See, I love you, Papa, you did all you could do. And they say the truth hurts, so I lied to you. Yes, I lied to you. I love the blues.
News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line. Ah, man, I just want to keep playing that song. It sounds so good, and it's just such a great sequence in the movie that we're about to discuss, which is, I don't know about you, Jeremy, but my pick for movie of the year so far. And that is Sinners, the film by Ryan Coogler. That's been out for a couple of weeks now. We hadn't had a chance to discuss it in depth, but this was one of my most anticipated movies of the year. And I got to say, it absolutely lived up to that anticipation. This is the only movie I've seen twice this year so far.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, just fantastic film. And if you don't know, you know, if you've somehow missed all the discussion on this, because there's been a lot of discussion about this movie. A lot of discussion in the lead up and a lot of discussion in the, I think it's been 3 weeks since it came out at this point. Just about the film itself and about the world that it lives in. You know, this is a, without spoiling anything, I don't think it's spoiling anything because we've all seen the commercials. We should know that this is a vampire movie by now.
Mm-hmm.
From Dusk Till Dawn before it, though, it doesn't really reveal that it's a vampire movie until probably a little more than halfway through the film. So if you hadn't seen trailers, and I, you know, actually second time I saw it, got to see it with a friend who had not seen the trailers and didn't know. So that was pretty cool. But this is primarily a movie that is taking place in the Jim Crow South and dealing with, you know, what that world is like and what it is like to be not just African-American, although primarily there are a lot of African-Americans in this film, but what it's like to be a minority in that time period. We do see a few Asian people in this film as well. And then we've got this character played by my imaginary girlfriend, Haley Steinfeld, who is, has grown up as part of this world, although she's kind of outside this world because she's like, I think in the movie, do they say that her mother's father was half black? Is that what it was?
Yeah, she's,
like an eighth black?
12.5% black.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Well, I mean, there
so
used to be,
white,
you know, without getting into, you know, the way that that kind of stuff used to be parsed, there used to be words for that. I mean, I'm not going to use them because I think they're racist as hell, but, there would be a word for somebody that was 1/8 black or somebody that was, one quarter or whatever, they'd parse it because if you were even that, you were not white.
So
she's very much, you know, it's kind of a subplot of this movie, this particular character that I think is very interesting that we can get into. But before we get into that, what are your thoughts overall on the movie, Jeremy?
Yeah, it is phenomenal. I feel like, in a way, it is doing for blues music what Oh Brother, Where Art Thou did for, bluegrass music back when that movie came out many, many years ago. Obviously, this is a different type of film, but kind of takes place in a similar era. And the fact that you and I grew up where we did, I mean, here in particular on the Gulf Coast, I know you're from Tampa, but here in particular on the Gulf Coast, blues music is very ingrained in our culture, and to see it represented in film, I think, is something that does kind of transcend race. And I think that's kind of one of the beautiful things about growing up in the South, is I know that for many, many reasons, we are even still to this day backwards at some times, but there is a level of integration here that I think many of us, myself included, have a deep appreciation for Black culture and their contributions to the arts. And I think this movie explores that in a really brilliant way. Like, myself, I am a patron of the arts, and I would love to go out and support artists and, you know, kind of be able to contribute to a culture without actually taking from that culture.
Mm-hmm.
In a systemically white society, the nature of our relationship with Black culture is one that has always sort of been vampiric, in the way that Elvis Presley and Dolly Parton have been having number one singles that were actually just taken from Black artists who will never have the same kind of notoriety, who died penniless. And what's interesting about that is Elvis Presley never intended on that to be the thing that happened. It was a reverence for him, but just out of a nature of the way that things are, it's just a byproduct of it. And that's one of the things that I thought was really interesting about the themes of Sinners, is the vampires almost, to me, are liberalism, where the KKK, which plays a significant role in the film, are kind of what I would consider to be modern, you know, very right-wing ideology. And so, like, one is the devil, you know, you can identify them, you can see them, and the other still has an insidiousness, because despite this idea of wanting everything to be equal, the core of our society is, and historically has been, one that is quicker to take than to give. And it's the exploitation of all artists across all races. But when you look at the demographics, how many people in America are Black versus how popular Black music is, Black athletes are, it's like they contribute so greatly to the overall cultural landscape and historically have not been rewarded for it. And that's why I think it is so incredible that Ryan Coogler was able to secure the deal that he did on this film. I think it's amazing. The cast in this movie is incredible, and it does kind of talk about even the construct of whiteness, where, like, the vampires seem to be, like, Irish. And if you know the Irish history, the Italian history, like, for the longest time, they weren't even treated at the same level as, you know, the Protestants that came over before them. And so, like, it explores all of this stuff within the context of just a really cool crime vampire movie that is just top to bottom really, really well done. I know that was a big tangent, but I got a lot out of this movie.
No, yeah. I mean, that's an aspect that I don't think has been talked about as much, in that the vampires kind of seek to consume all of this culture and make it their own.
Yeah.
And I mean, and that's, you know, certainly what happened. Although the leader of these vampires that we see is Irish, you get the feeling that he was subsumed into that vampire culture too. So,
yes,
you know, that's a really interesting perspective, and one I hadn't spent a whole lot of time thinking about. I think this film just also has a lot to say about race in general. It has a lot to say about good versus evil. It has a lot to say about people coming together versus you know, versus what separates them. And above all of that, it's just a hugely entertaining film.
It really is. And I've heard people say that it's slow at the beginning. I totally disagree. And I'm sure you do as well. Like, all of the work that's put into developing these characters and this world is so important to making everything that happens, you know, when the showdown happens, matter. And once you realize, like, oh man, these characters aren't, some of these guys aren't going to make it out of here. Like, it sucks, because you like them and you care about them. And I think that's, like, the mark of a really good horror movie. And it feels even reductive to just say this is a horror movie, but luckily we're getting to a place where, like, horror films can actually say something and do something. And I think this one just, it's spinning a lot of plates, and it's able to balance them super well.
Yeah, it's very much an elevated horror movie. It's uh-huh. more than just a horror movie, but obviously it has that at its core. And it's interesting, because I had read an interview with Ryan Coogler shortly before the film was released, that he was talking about some of his some of his signposts for this film, some of the films that came before it that he saw as inspirations and guidelines. And I can absolutely see things like, you know, I mentioned already From Dusk Till Dawn was being one of them. Things like Assault on Precinct 13.
There's a scene that's very similar to The Blood Test in The Thing.
Yeah, the early John Carpenter stuff. And, you know, and also things like, you know, he mentioned Spielberg in here. And there's definitely some very Spielbergian things. I think that this movie is like about 99% perfect. I think there's a couple of places where Coogler doesn't trust the audience to get what he's doing and feel like, and I'm specifically thinking about the montage at the end where things keep flashing back to earlier in the movie for you to just in case you didn't realize this is what we're talking about here. It's like, yeah, dude, trust the audience. We get it. We get that.
Half of the people that watch this are going to be second screening it, which makes me sick. So maybe they actually do need it spelled out that way, but I agree with you.
Maybe, but I mean, as an adult who watched this in the theater, just rapt two times, I didn't personally need it. But yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe the home audience needs it. I think it's really interesting too that, you know, you mentioned the deal that Coogler made to make this movie. First of all, they gave him, you know, something like $100 million to make this movie, an original project, not based on some previous IP, which is almost unheard of in this day and age. He also struck a deal that in 25 years, he gets the rights back to this movie.
Yeah.
Which is really cool. You know, he's going to, in the long term, own this film. He's going to own this piece of art, which I think, you know, frankly, should happen more often.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, interestingly, just to put us off on a separate quick tangent before we go to a break here, the last thing that we've seen like this, which is a movie I don't think was as successful creatively and certainly not as financially as Sinners was, that being Francis Ford Coppola's Megalopolis, which came out late last year, which he completely self-financed and he owns. And in fact, I just read an article this week about how this movie has kind of disappeared intentionally on Coppola's part. He is refusing to release this for any kind of home media. He does not want this film viewed on TV screens and phones.
Interesting.
So he's going to go out and do tour screenings with this film, but you're not going to be able to buy it on DVD. You're not going to be able to see it on Netflix.
I didn't know that.
It's his piece of art. He can do that with it. Whereas if he had done this with a studio deal, it would already be streaming. So it's very interesting. We'll see what Coogler does with it in the long terms. But, you know, if you haven't seen this movie already, go see it on the big screen while you still can. We got to take a break. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line. We're going to move on to what is probably one of the biggest movies of the year so far, and certainly poised to be one of the bigger movies of the summer, although that doesn't seem to mean as much as it used to from a financial standpoint. At any rate, we are talking about Thunderbolts asterisk. Important to include that asterisk as part of the title in there. We're not going to really get into the reasons why that is today. We're going to give a couple more weeks for the spoilers to get out there. Although, you know, in fairness, I don't think Marvel has terribly restrained themselves from spoiling what that asterisk means a week after this movie has come out. But we're going to hold off for just a little while longer in case you haven't been spoiled yet. But we're going to plan in a couple of weeks to talk a little more in depth about this film and what its repercussions are for the wider Marvel Cinematic Universe. But we're just going to talk a little bit about Thunderbolts asterisk and you kind of give some overall impressions on the movie. So, Jeremy, how'd you feel about this one?
I'm not going to be hyperbolic. I'm not going to be one of the people that says Marvel's back. That's something that gets thrown out a lot in terms of this movie specifically. Clearly, Marvel hasn't gone anywhere. They're just perpetually in motion, cranking out projects. But I will say I'm back. I have not felt this strongly about a Marvel movie since Avengers Endgame. And I mean, I know there are some other good ones. No Way Home, the Spider-Man movie, that was very cool. There was things about it certainly that I was very excited about. Guardians of the Galaxy 3, I thought it was good. It's a little overlong. It didn't really focus on the team dynamic in a way that I missed Gamora. There were other things about it that just, it didn't quite hit in the same way that, obviously the earlier, the first Guardians movie did. But for me, I got old school, I'm in love with the MCU feelings watching Thunderbolts asterisk. And if you've been paying attention to this radio show for any period of time, you know, Julio and I have been discussing these movies for a long time. I saw every single Marvel movie from, Iron Man all the way through the Infinity Saga opening weekend in the theaters. And I've been missing that magic. Going and seeing the Thunderbolts reminded me of why I love these movies. Florence Pugh is just such a special actress that even among peers that are also really talented, I mean, so many of the cast members in Thunderbolts and the broader MCU are so good, but Florence Pugh is just, she's just better. She can take that very same material and make it have such an impact. I love the chemistry between the characters. I will say, for about 20 minutes at the beginning, I was kind of trying to find my footing as far as like the tone or whether or not I enjoyed it. But as it went along and as the relationships continue to kind of grow, I fell in love with it. I think what they were able to pull off with this film and kind of, I don't know, B-list characters from shows that a lot of people haven't seen, I thought it was exceptional. So, yeah, big, big fan. I'm going to say like 4 out of 5 stars on this one.
Yeah, this is very much Florence Pugh's movie. She is the lead of this movie. And she she carries the weight of this movie on her shoulders, and she does it effortlessly. She is so good. Everybody's good in this, but she is the one that elevates us to next level. I'm going to backtrack to what you said about this being the best movie since Endgame. I don't know about that. I go to best movie since Guardians 3. I disagree with some of what you said about Guardians 3. I think Guardians 3 stuck the landing. And I think it very much is an apt conclusion to that trilogy of films. And I think it's a really special movie. I think that there is a lot that the Guardians movies and this movie have in common.
And that's why I did take a second key in, because I agree. Go ahead.
Yeah. Both of these films, or sets of films, I guess I should say, are very much about found dysfunctional families.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, making a family where amongst people that had no family, basically. And, there's the relationship between Alexi and Yelena, but, you know, there was a relationship between Yondu and Star-Lord too. So, you know, there are parallels there. I don't think it's as consistently quippy as Guardians is, which is good, because this is in some ways a little bit more serious movie. I think both of these films, or sets of films in the case of Guardians, have a lot to say, but they're not saying the same things, which is good. And they're not saying them in exactly the same way, which is good.
This one really does put the text in bold and underlined it, but I still think it does it really well. I mean, it's a movie kind of about depression and finding your place in the world through community and through friends. And it's not subtle about it, but it handles it in a way that I think is just universal and relatable.
It's not subtle about it, but I don't think it's ham-handed about it either.
No, that's fair.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you say, oh, well, it's not very subtle, it's like, you know, I always think of, did you ever see Don't Be a Menace to South Central While Drinking Your Juice in the Hood?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so great parody of, you know, in the 90s there were all these black movies with a message that were out there, and this movie was a parody of all of those movies. It was a parody of, you know, they're all there in the title: Menace to Society, uh-huh, and Boys in the Hood, and Juice, yeah, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And all of those movies had a message, and more often than not, that message was not subtle. And so when they parodied these movies, it was the Wayans brothers that did this film. Every time they hit a message in the film, Keenan Ivory Wayans would literally turn to the camera and say, "Message!"
Yeah.
And like most of the time he was playing a postal carrier, so he was delivering a letter at the time. But there's even one time where he's a baby in a crib, and he's, you know.
Yeah, it's so good.
And so it's not like that. It's not going to that extent of just hitting you over the head with it. But yeah, you don't have to look terribly far to find the metaphor either. Yeah, and it really is encapsulated in this character Bob, who we've seen in the trailers, who, without spoiling anything, is technically two very different characters within the scope of this movie that will drive this whole thing home. I just thought, you know, overall the performances were great, the set pieces were great. It's not one of these big, everything ends with a big whirling lights in the sky and everybody fighting this one giant monster and a bunch of people shooting rays out of their hands. It's a lot of it's very practical. It's a little bit scaled down. It's not, you know, it's in that regard, it's not the same third act that we've seen in a lot of these Marvel movies.
No, you know, going back to
what you said about the whole notion of Marvel is back. I will still maintain to this day, I'm not talking about series here. Series are another story. Marvel has not made an unwatchable movie. Like every movie they've put out has been wholly a very watchable film. So are some of them better than others? Yeah. Am I going back to this before I go back to, say, Eternals? Sure. But I've gone back to Eternals, and Eternals is better than people give it credit for. So
I think there's something to be said about, and my personal experience, what it isn't saying is that the other movies are bad. It's rekindling that thing that made them better than good. They were special to me. And in a way, I felt like Thunderbolts gave me that feeling. It didn't recapture the highest highs, but it certainly reminded me of why I've been so invested in this thing since the beginning. And that's a big mark on the side of positive, regardless of like things that I could pull out of it and say, hey, maybe this and this and this, that's all fine. It's the feeling that I got reminding me why I'm such a fan of the Marvel movies in the first place.
You know what, though, dude? Speaking as a guy that comes from the comics, it's sort of kind of the nature of serialized storytelling. There's going to be ebbs and flows. There's going to be peaks and valleys. And you can't have every story have the stakes that Endgame had. And yeah, it's natural that there's going to be a slope down after a peak like that. And I think we've gone through this slope down and we're now on the curve up because we're heading back up to the next big event.
Yeah, so for sure.
Were there missteps in there? Were there places where they made mistakes? Sure. Are there some damn good movies in there? And I'm talking about movies like the last Spider-Man film. I'm talking about Guardians 3. I'm talking about Deadpool and Wolverine.
Shang-Chi is awesome.
Yeah, Shang-Chi. You know, there's some damn good movies in there. And there's some movies in there that are entertaining enough to watch once or twice and not really think too much about.
Quantumania.
Yeah, Quantumania, The Marvels, you know. Mm-hmm. I had a good time with those films. Have I felt the need to go back and watch them again? Not so much.
And I did too. Like I'm not one of the detractors in that way. Like I did enjoy, like pretty much every Marvel movie, I've enjoyed it. So more than watchable, they're all pretty good. Yeah.
But this one is on another level. And we are going to talk about this more in a couple of weeks, and we'll get into a lot of the spoilers and a lot more of the what this means for the overall Marvel universe. We got to take a break. Back with more in just a moment. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.
used to let the mic smoke. Now I slam it when I'm done and make sure it's broke. When I'm gone, no one gets on, cause I won't let nobody press up and mess up the scene I set. I like to stand in a crowd and watch the people wonder, damn. But think about a thing you understand. I'm just an addict, addicted to music. Maybe it's a habit, I gotta use it. Even if it's jazz or the quiet storm, I hunk a beat up, converted into hip-hop form. Write a rhyme and graffiti in every show you see me in. Deep concentration, cause I'm no comedian. Jokers are wild, if you wanna be tame, I treat you like a child and you're gonna be named. Another enemy, not even a friend of me, cause you'll get fried in the end when you pretend to be competing. Cause I just put your mind on pause and I complete when you compare my rhyme with yours. I wake you up and as I stare in your face, you seem stunned. Remember me, the one you got your idea from. But soon you start to suffer, the tuna get rougher. When you start to stutter, that's when you had enough of fighting it'll make you choke. You can't provoke, you can't cope. You should have broke because I ain't no joke.
News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I'm your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Brinch with us on the line. Jeremy, 80s hip-hop just hits different.
Yeah, it does. Absolutely.
It just does in a very good way. And we're playing that because that song was used in the new movie Clown in a Cornfield, which just came out this weekend. Although it was used in a context that, you know, put a giant stake through my heart, and that, you know, this was being played by a dad with his 17-year-old daughter who hits him with, the 80s is as far from me as the 40s was from you. And It's mathematically accurate. Doesn't make it hurt any less.
No. Crazy.
Yeah, it's true. You know, if you think about it, I mean, 85 was 40 years ago. And so 40 years before 85 was 45. It's the end of World War II. So
yeah, talk about like a blank spot of culture, but that's a whole other conversation. But like, well, I don't know. 80s music seems so quintessential, and I don't think I could name anything from the 40s.
Well, I could definitely name some stuff from the 40s, but I think that the stuff from the 80s has more presence in 2025 than stuff from the 40s had in 1985.
Right.
I think that's fair. There are certainly exceptions, but you know, it's not really the point of what we're talking about here, which is this new movie Clown in a Cornfield, which just came out. So we're going to keep this as spoiler free as we can in this discussion, because a lot of people haven't had time to see this yet. And I don't know, do you think this is a movie that a lot of people are going to go see, Jeremy? First of all,
judging by opening night, you and I and couple of friends went and saw it, and we were about the only people there. There might have been 10 people in the theater for its first screening. Granted, it was a little bit early. I think we went to a 6 p.m. So, you know, but it was, I don't think so, Julio. The short answer is I really don't think so. It's one of those Shudder produced movies. I don't think it's going to have the kind of rave reviews that something like Terrifier would, which I say because it's also a clown movie.
Well, Terrifier Terrifier has rave audience reviews. It does not have rave critical reviews.
No, right.
Yeah, this has gotten good critical reviews. About. This is running in the 80% range on Rotten Tomatoes.
Absurd. So absolutely absurd.
It is getting good reviews. It's not getting, like, to compare it to another Shudder movie, Late Night with the Devil reviews. What was the one that Shudder put out a couple of years ago? The Spanish language one. It was really good.
I'm not going to be able to think of it, but it was very good.
When I got to see Patton Oswalt do stand up comedy a few weeks ago, and he actually mentioned this film on stage too. It's just gone out of my head. Shudder makes some interesting movies, and this is based on a popular YA novel too. So there is that, you know, that you may get some of the young adult audience go see this, although this is an R-rated film, if I'm not mistaken. But I thought it was interesting because it plays on a lot of iconography that we're familiar with from horror movies. You know, certainly scary clowns is not anything new. Certainly murders happening in a cornfield are not anything new. We've seen, absolutely seen those things before. But I think that's kind of what this film is playing on. It's playing on your familiarity with these tropes and how it can put a postmodern spin on the on those tropes. Like, it's not rewriting anything really, but it is having fun with the conventions of those tropes and how they apply to, what are we calling this now, Gen Alpha?
Yeah.
You know, we've got, you know, 17-year-olds. There's literally a moment when they're trying to run to get help, and they're trying to find, they're going to this home where they know there's a landline phone, and they get in there and it's a rotary dial phone and they don't know how to use it.
Things
like that, you know, things like, we can't get cell service, a couple things like that where it's, you know, they can't figure out how to drive stick, you know?
That's a good bit that recurs through it. This is directed by Eli Craig. Julio and I've kind of talked about it in the past. That's the director that did Tucker and Dale versus Evil. Both of us really big fans of that. So I think both of us were looking forward to it.
Yeah, and Tucker and Dale versus Evil is a much better film than this. Let's just put that on.
Oh my goodness.
Street.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Katie Douglas plays Quinn Maybrook, and then Aaron Abrams plays her father. I didn't recognize any of the cast members in this other than Kevin Durand, who you might have seen in Abigail, as well as a lot of other stuff. He was in Lost, I think.
Yeah.
Father-daughter moved to a small remote town that's kind of been forgotten in time to escape some trauma that they had in the past. And the girl gets to befriend a group of kids who create online horror videos, which are cool. Like, the movies that they're making within the movie are cool. And they all center around this local kind of mascot of a corn syrup industry that kind of kept them on the map. It's a clown. What's his name?
Friendo the Clown.
Yeah.
I thought that was a great postmodern touch too. These movies within a movie and how nobody believes anything's happening because they've all seen these videos that these kids are making. I thought that was a very 2025 touch.
It's a pretty cool mask also, as far as like horror villains go. I don't think it's going to like earn its spot in that pantheon, but it's a creepy clown mask. It's not just clown makeup. What do you think about that part of it?
I like that a lot. I mean, there is weirdly a whole lot of horror clowns out there. You know, of course you've got Pennywise, you've got Art the Clown from Terrifier, you've got the Killer Clowns from Outer Space, you've got, you know. So this is somebody that's joining that pantheon of, for lack of a better term, killer clowns. But yeah, I thought he was distinctive enough. And I think that without spoiling anything, one of the things that I think is the most fun about this film is that the title itself is kind of a misnomer.
Yeah, good point.
And it's one of the things that keeps you guessing, because this is very much in a lot of ways kind of a whodunit kind of horror movie. It's very much a who's going to be the guy under the mask. And there are places where it wants to mislead you into being one of two young men that are part of or are on the fringes of this friend group that forms in this movie.
Just cut it out. You know what you're doing. You're talking too much about the mystery of the movie. What did you think about the kills?
I think some of the kills were a lot of fun. And some of the fake kills were almost more fun than some of the real kills.
Agreed. That's a good point. There's some good fake out stuff in this. But look, this is the thing. Talking about the 40s to the 80s, I was talking to Julio after we got out of the movie about potentially doing a show about slashers sometimes, where we just kind of discuss it. And I'm thinking of it in two different eras. There's the pre-Scream and there's the post-Scream. Well, at this point in our current timeline, we have been more influenced by Scream than A Nightmare on Elm Street. I mean, obviously Halloween is going to be the kind of granddaddy of them all, but that whole postmodern thing, that's been what slasher movies have been for decades now. And if it's going to leave an impression on me, it needs characters that I don't actively dislike. And this movie is full of the most stock, bland characters. The deaths aren't even meant to really evoke any sort of like empathy. It is so disposable, and I'm not going to say it's not a good time, because I think if you're a horror fan, you're going to enjoy watching it, but I am hard pressed to like, this is not a good movie.
I think it's a good movie. I don't think it's a great movie. But that being said, I'm going to partially disagree with you. Yes, most of the characters that don't survive are very stock characters, but I think they come up with a good twist with some of the characters that do survive without spoiling
anything. You are dying to give this movie away, dude.
No, I'm not going to give it away. I'm just saying they come up with a good twist with some of the characters, and I think the lead girl is great.
She's no Sidney Prescott.
Well, but dude, sure, but Sidney Prescott is no Jamie Lee Curtis.
I disagree. I don't know. I get what you're saying.
She's not Heather Langenkamp or any of the 80s Scream. I mean, Scream was a reaction to those films.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that we've gotten the reaction film to Scream yet.
What is it? It's just an earnest, like maybe Halloween 2018 was kind of that, because it just was like, let's go back to the basics and do something that's effective in its most earnest terms. And I actually thought it was a pretty good slasher.
Yeah, and I can't believe I said Jamie Lee Curtis and not Laurie Strode. Shame on me.
It's fine.
But all our horror heads out there, they know who I'm at.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, I don't know. I had fun with this movie. Am I going to go see it again in the theater? No. Will I maybe watch it again on a plane sometime? I might.
I might put it on as well. Yep.
Yeah, it was fun. Like I said, it's no Tucker and Dale versus Evil, but that movie was really special. And this film is fun. I wouldn't have minded seeing some of the people from that film show up in this, though. Like, it would have been nice if Eli Craig could have called on. I know how busy Alan Tudyk is right now, but if he could have called on, like, Katrina Bowden or Tyler Labine or something, just for a little cameo.
Yeah, just for even little roles.
Yeah, that would have been some fun. But it is a fun movie, and if you like horror, I'd advise you to check it out. That's about all the time we got for this week. We'll be back next week with more. Until then, you're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.